Good evening. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Joe. I'm a member of the Wednesday night study group here in Pompano Beach that meets at 8 o'clock on Wednesday night at Christ Church, which is right up the street. And we encourage you to come out. We study the book in a method that was set up by my sponsor in 1983, and we're celebrating our 30-year anniversary next month. And if you've never been there and you've been to a Big Book seminar, it's a similar format. And if you've never been to a Big Book seminar, I highly recommend it. There's a lot of new people here tonight. A lot of people that have never been to an AA meeting here tonight. And welcome. Welcome, welcome. You're off the hook. You've got an opportunity to explore and realize a life that you never thought was possible. Ever. We have been talking over the last several weeks and coming to some conclusions and kind of like in this realization phase where we find out who we are and what we are and why we are and what's needed to take us out from that. You know, we find out that we're powerless over alcohol and any other mood or mind-altering substance. Because of the fact that when we put it in, we cannot stop or we have little control over the amount we take. If that's your deal, if that's your story, if that fits for your experience of addiction, then you've got the first piece to the puzzle. The second piece to the puzzle is this mental aspect where when we stop, we can't stop starting. Irregardless of the fact that it's killing us, it's annihilating everything worthwhile in life, we become the loneliest people on the planet. We're full of discouragement, full of loneliness, full of failure, full of regret, full of remorse. That somehow, some way, we can have a conversation with ourselves that literally where we're able to give ourselves permission to put the substance that's killing us in our body. So we can't stop and we can't stop starting. And nobody on the face of the planet has been able to keep us stopped. Nobody. We've tried them all, haven't we? We've tried every known method that we could possibly summon on planet Earth, and nothing and no one and no institution was able to keep us stopped. We always started again because of this thing they call an obsession of the mind. See, we're on this track of life. We were born, we're given certain unchangeable things like our race and our identity and our name and our siblings and so forth and so on. We're born into a community and we begin to grow up. And at a certain point of growing up, we begin to be able to absorb information. And we're given the definition of life and right and wrong and our religion and, you know, what's proper, what's not proper, you know, what's success and what's not success, what's appropriate and inappropriate, right and wrong. And we go with that. You know, it's not like it's a debatable thing when we're 4 or 5 years old. It becomes our track. It becomes our understanding of life and how we're supposed to live it and respond to it and navigate through it. Somewhere along the line, we begin to drink and drug. And we do our thing and life becomes out of control. So we learn a lot of things very early on, where we get hardened into this philosophy of life and how it should work and how I should play the game and so forth. And things start to go sideways on us. You know, we start to play this game, this ever-pretending game that we talked about last week. We start to pretend not to be who we really are. We start to pretend I'm being who you think I need to be. What's going to gain me in good favor with you? And we start to go on this masquerade and become somebody that we're not. And all the while, we start to sell our soul in the process. We become angry and indignant, fearful, judgmental, condescending, dishonest. Many of us become habitual liars, even when the truth would serve us better. And we realize that ultimately we drink ourselves into such a state where we're at a crossroads. We're at the turning point. It's either go on to the bitter end or accept spiritual help. That's what AA says. If spiritual help is not what you're looking for and you're adamantly opposed to it, you don't need to be in AA because you're going to be fighting it the whole way. There may be some other programs out there that have a different human solution, but the facts are the facts. They don't work out real well for a real alcoholic. Okay? The real alcoholic is the person that's lost all ability to control his drinking once he begins to drink. And then we have the obsession that somehow, someday, we'll be able to control our drinking like normal people. That somehow, someday, we'll be able to function and drink successfully. And that day never comes, does it? And we find ourselves at the bitter end, at the turning point. And we make a decision. Through the process, we get to step three. We say, I know that I'm a real alcoholic. I know that my life and my thinking is unmanageable. See, my thinking must be unmanageable in order for my life to be unmanageable. Because every action that transpires in our life has an ancestor. It's called a thought. We think before we act. And then we actually think before we feel, which perpetuates the action. So we think, we feel, we act, and we get a result. And if you're here tonight and you don't like the results you've been getting, you've got to change the way you've been thinking. And see, that's what Silkworth was talking about in the doctor's opinion when he said that this action of detoxing and retoxing over and over and over, succumbing to the desire, as so many of us do, right? That this happens over and over and over unless this person, and this, if it fits, could be you, must undergo an entire psychic change, or there's very little hope of recovery. That's a tall order. Especially for somebody that, you know, like me, that said, how in God's name do you get that? You know what I mean? How do you get that? Well, certainly no human solution was going to do it for me. So we made the decision to seek. And immediately when we make this decision to seek, we find out that it's not you that I've got to change, or that you've got to start behaving. It's that I've got to investigate me. I've got to start looking inside. They say our decision to seek is a good and vital thing to do, but it'll have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. And then they go on they give us this thing about the caution. You know, we may think we have to stop telling a few lies here and there. We may think we have to become honest in some areas of our life. We think we may have to be doing certain behaviors differently and acting better, right? We're not going to act better unless we think differently. If we think the same, we're going to act the same. It can't not happen. One follows the other, right? So they tell us that it's the disease of self. That this manifestation of ourselves in this selfishness and self-centeredness and self-absorption is the root of all our troubles. They say this selfishness, that we must be rid of it or it kills us. We must be rid of the selfishness or it kills us. Well, how do you do that? Well, they've got this whole thing laid out. We've got to find out how self manifested in various ways is what had defeated us. How we made decisions based on ourself, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. They say we're full of resentment. We're full of fear. We're full of the regret, remorse, and shame of the harms we did to others. Of the lives we trampled on. Of the lives we abandoned. And we got to take a look at this stuff. Because if we can't identify... if I can't identify what I did to you, I'm still going to blame you for what you did to me. That's not going to produce any good results. It'll keep me being a victim. Teresa and I were having dinner tonight, and we were mentioning some people, and I know a lot of people in the military. There's probably a lot of people in the military here, and they've identified this thing called post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's a very real thing. As a matter of fact, they've come out with a lot of disorders that are four-letter acronyms. And I'm going to share one with you tonight that I heard at church on Sunday that I thought was profound. That I really thought was profound. Because I'm going to tell you something. Alcoholics like you and me, if you're a real alcoholic, we suffer from such regret from the past. That the past is literally dictating our future. It's because we're always filtering the choices and decisions that we make moving ahead from what we experienced in the past. And if you're anything like me, one of the prayers I had was, please don't let me feel today like I did yesterday. Or like I did the day before, or the year before, or the year before that. I didn't want to feel inadequate. I didn't want to feel like, you know, a bother to people. A hindrance to people. I didn't want to feel like a loser. I didn't want to feel like a man that couldn't keep his word and was untrustworthy. I didn't want to feel like a predator against the human race. Nobody wants to feel those things. But when you drink and drug as selfishly as we do, it can't not happen. It says we're like a tornado roaring through the lives of others. With no remorse or shame in the act. Until we get to a place where we get sober and it's eating us alive. So this thing that our pastor was talking about on Sunday really hit a chord with me, and I'm going to read it to you. It says, this is a disorder modeled after post-traumatic stress disorder. Some psychiatrists are proposing that this is a mental disorder because they believe there are people who have become so bitter they can barely function. German psychiatrist Michael Linden, who has conducted research on a proposed disorder, describes its effect on people. They feel the world has treated them unfairly. Sounds familiar. He says it's one step more complex than anger. They're angry plus helpless. He says that people with this disorder are almost always treatment resistant. These people usually don't come to treatment because the world has to change, not me. Believes that 1% to 2% of people are affected at any given time. And it explains that although sufferers of the disorder tend to have a desire for vengeance, revenge is not a treatment. Imagine that. That's like drinking the poison you want somebody else to die from, you know what I'm saying? Or banging yourself on the hammer to make the ache go away. PTED, as it's stated, post-traumatic embitterment disorder, stipulates a violation of strong basic beliefs. We get back into that old attitudes, ideas, and beliefs. Think about this. We're addicted to them and entrenched in them when we get here. But they believe that the strong basic beliefs is a cause for pervasive mood, not of depression or anxiety, but feelings of injustice or embitterment. Basic beliefs can be conceptualized as value systems that are learned in childhood and adolescence. Isn't that amazing? I just found out I had this on Sunday. I have PTED. Amazing. Wonder what it'll be next week. I find out I got stuff all the time, especially when I go to church. These are some of the reasons that I have this PTED, this embittered feeling, this angry, victim, depressed type of stuff going on when I get here. That if it's not addressed and if it's not cleaned up, I'm going to drink again. See, we're going to talk about a step tonight that says if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Matter of fact, most of the steps that we talk about moving forward, that if we skip these vital steps, we may not overcome drinking. And if we're able to stay stopped, we're going to be the most miserable people on the planet, because we're still going to be regretful. We're still going to be full of shame. We're still going to be so self-conscious, we'll never let you see who I am. So the masquerade will continue. We'll be bitter, judgmental, condescending, angry people. And the only people that you'll have in your circle are exactly the same type of people, because you're the only ones that'll listen. Says many people, and we talked last week about these instincts of character, and these are central, these are core to what we've got to establish and get a handle on moving forward. Okay? We do step four, we listed our resentments, we listed what those people did to us, we listed what it had affected in our instincts of character, either it was our personal security, our living, our shelter, or our nourishment to survive. We talked about our emotional security. We talked about our financial security. We talked about our sexual security. We found out in the 12 and 12 what those instincts were right and for. Why we were given to them by God. Right? Okay? But somewhere along the line, they began to dominate and rule our lives because we never could get enough. So our deal was selfishness and self-centeredness, always trying to acquire more of that stuff. Never once did we try to be a man amongst men or a girl amongst women or part of a society or part of a community. Never did we try to be authentic, individual, float above the herd type of people. We wanted to be in our comfort zones, and that's just the way we lived our life. So these internal drives or instincts that they're called basically dominated. They say that every serious emotional disturbance. If you're emotionally disturbed in here tonight, just, you know, do a reality check. Are you emotionally disturbed about something? Them, her, him, it, your job, your position in life, your place in recovery, whatever it is. Are you emotionally disturbed? They say that every emotional disturbance can be seen as a case of misdirected instinct. Every one of them. We can always go back to those things and find out why I'm affected. If somebody threatens one of those things, I'm going to be affected. I'm going to be sore. I'm going to probably plot a little vengeance if I don't have an adequate way of getting out of it. If I don't have an adequate way of processing it by talking to somebody about it, and it's going to fester just like a boil. We all know what those are. They're very painful until they pop and we get relief. But vengeance does not provide that relief. And the whole idea of the fourth step, when we get behind identifying what it is they did that was threatening, we start to look at our own part in the deal. There's only one way to have forgiveness in your heart. And that's to look at those resentments that we've been carrying around forever and to see our part in the deal. See, we blaming them and it for everything. For everything. But when we really look at it, through our behavior, through our whole relationship with that individual, what we were trying to get out of that relationship in a selfish and self-centered way, we see that we made decisions based on satisfaction, self-satisfaction, that later placed us in a position to be hurt, where they either retaliated or just walked away. And once we can see our part in it, we see that it wasn't all their fault. And immediately you start to have forgiveness in your heart. We're going to talk about the main source of forgiveness tonight. Confession is something that's been going on for thousands and thousands of years, and every religion utilizes it. It's a necessary thing. But alcoholics don't do that. They walk around and harbor this stuff, pretending that the truth doesn't exist, and they're mad at the world. We navigate through life cautious and guarded and wrapped up and concealed and manipulative and just we have the walls up. And that's how we go through life. We don't confess. We blame. But what are the prices we've been paying for that? What are the prices? I know the prices that I paid for it. I wanted to eat a bullet when I got here. I hated life. Because you were never going to change. Imagine that. That was my story. I couldn't live with y'all. I hated you. And I hated me. Something had to be done. I had to discover the truth about the stock and trade. You know what I mean? I was not a happy person when I got here. I had no joy. I had no purpose. I had no destiny. I was just existing as most of us do. Okay? Think about this for a minute. Many people are driven by guilt. Think about this. They spend their entire lives running from regrets and hiding their shame. Guilt-driven people are manipulated by memories. They allow their past to literally dictate their future. They unconsciously punish themselves by sabotaging their futures. Many people are driven by resentment and anger. They hold on to hurts and never get over them. You'll hear those, you'll see that in people when they talk in stories about something that happened 10 years earlier or 20 years earlier. People tell stories from the long, far past because there's a payoff. And most of the time, it's emotional sympathy and emotional support and consolation and validation from others that they're telling the story to. Or at least that's the payoff they're seeking. It's the payoff they're seeking. Why else would they tell the story? What value does it have? What value does living in any of that stuff have for us? It has no value to live in the past. But a lot of us will wallow around in it. We've got to come to grips with it. And confession is one of the key things. Fifth step. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of the wrongs. And I can always find my part in the deal. And if I didn't have a part in the deal, I created a part in the deal. And held people hostage. Many people are driven by resentment and anger. They hold on to old hurts and never get over them. They spend their days plotting revenge and retribution, rehearsing it over and over. They waste their lives away by drinking the poison they want others to die from. Their anger builds and builds, and it is released one of two ways. Sometimes they internalize it. Others explode. Usually the explosion results from an incident completely unrelated to the built-up resentment. See, the poison is festering inside us, and the actual explosion has already been teed up and set up. And all it's going to take is somebody to offend me. The number one reason an alcoholic walks directly into a bar and orders a drink with impunity, thinking that they're going to get away from it, or that it's going to be different this time, or that nobody will know, in spite of the evidence, they say we can't bring into our mind with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and devastation of a day, a week, or a month prior. But what drives an alcoholic into a bar, or into a liquor store, or into a crack den, or into a pill mill to put the poison in his body or her body that's been killing him? I'm going to tell you the number one and two reasons. Resentment and fear. Resentment and fear. Many people are driven by fear, regardless of the cause. Fear-driven people often miss great opportunities because they're afraid to venture out, to risk. Instead, they play it safe to maintain status quo. Sounds like the herd mentality, doesn't it? You know that sheep flock in herds. Just like AA flocks in herds. And just like in sheep, they will follow each other off the cliff, as many in AA do. When I relate to going jumping off the cliff, it means to making the ultimate sacrifice of putting that stuff in your body. Fear is a self-imposed prison cell that will keep you from becoming what God created you to be. The only weapon against it is faith and love. So we've got to get on that. We've got to embark on that journey to establish faith. It starts with a belief. We found that out and we agnostics, we made a decision that we were believed, or we were at least going to be willing to believe. That's our cornerstone. And then in how it works, we said that God was going to be the director. Right? That the man or woman looking back at you in the mirror was doing a terrible, terrible job at running your life. And that God was going to be the director, and we're going to move in that direction. Now, I know that nobody in here has this fear or this drive, this instinctual drive for emotional security, but just take a listen anyway. Many people are driven by the need for approval. They allow the expectations of parents or spouses or children or teachers or friends or people in the fellowship or even complete strangers to control their lives. Others are driven by peer pressure, always worried of what others may think. Unfortunately, those who follow the crowd usually get lost in it. One sure key to failure is to try and please everybody. If you're frustrated by the consequences of the destinations you've driven yourself to with these drives, you've been driving yourself to a destination, right? Get out of the driver's seat and let someone or something else drive for you. That's what we do in step three. So they say that we've got to do this thing at once. We've got to embark on this investigation. And we did that. We talked about it last week. And we discovered that through this investigation, we finally were able to see the truth about the stock and trade. And one of the things that we hope to accomplish through this fact-finding and fact-facing process, this searching and fearless process, we're going to find the facts, find the truth, and accept the truth. And look at the hard truth. Okay? It's going to help us connect the dots. We find that we're moving towards a spiritual remedy of our malady, of our sickness. Okay? So we go through this thing, and we find out that we're a mess. We're a real mixed bag of nuts. We've been living on selfishness and self-centeredness the entire time. Full of fear, full of regret, full of remorse. And then in the last, and here's the most beautiful thing, that simply through making the decision and doing some work, okay, we're going to find that our first personality change or shift in our understanding, our interpretation or perception of life, that's different from who we were when we got here, comes through this investigation. And it says this. It says, if you've been thorough about our personal inventory and we have written down a lot, we have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to see, comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. Now, I'm going to tell you something. For us to see that is a miracle, given who we were when we got here. Because we sure weren't looking in the mirror. We were looking everywhere else. And to see that we have commenced to see the terrible destructiveness of our perception of life, of our drives in life, is amazing. We have begun to learn tolerance and patience and goodwill. What? We've begun to feel forgiveness because we've been able to forgive those that we've been blaming totally for our miserable life. Because we've been seeing that a lot of it was us. For we look on them as sick people. So we get this personality change, this shift in our thinking. We're told on page 71 that if you've already made a decision in an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you've made a good beginning. We've just begun. Okay? Then we get into action. Not into thinking. We get into action. It says in the first two lines, first three lines of chapter 6, it says, we have been trying to get a new attitude and a new relationship with our Creator and to discover the obstacles in our path. We have been trying to get a new attitude and a new relationship with our Creator. That's what we've been doing for the last five chapters. Okay? We've looked inward. We have admitted things. We got a new perspective on how we were affected and where the wrongs came from and why we were so burned up. And now we're prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle and get it from inside to outside. It says, we have admitted certain defects and have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. And that requires action on our part. Brings us to the fifth step of recovery. That we've admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature, the exact nature, the exact nature of our wrongs. Not the exact nature of their wrongs. The exact nature of our wrongs. And it's all going to center around these instincts. It says, it gives us a couple cautions. It said, because a lot of us say, well, why do we got to do that? You know, why do we got to go tell another human being? Well, humility is one big reason. The biggest reason, though, is that they say if we skip this vital step, then we're not going to overcome drinking. Ultimately, that's what we're after here, right? Permanent sobriety, emotional sobriety. See, I can get abstinent, but I miss a lot of the stuff that they're talking about in here. I don't want to remain restless, irritable, discontent. Does anybody in here want to remain restless, irritable, and discontent? Of course not. That's why we drank. Right? It says this. It says, trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods. And almost invariably, they got drunk. Is there anybody in here besides me that came into AA and never did a fifth step, got drunk? Anybody? Like, really? That's it? Huh? Is there anybody that's lying right now? Okay, we're right where we need to be. All the ones that raise their hand know there's lying going on. It says this, it says, they took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. The biggest payoff that we're going to get from doing a confession or a fifth step is forgiveness. The feeling of being one with humanity. You know, we're going to be able to take all the poison out of us and put it on the table. And we're going to be able to have somebody sitting across from us that's going to hopefully know what we're driving at. They say, we want this person to know what we're driving at. And I'm going to tell you, back in the day when they did this, from 1935 until 1937, they had 12 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not a lot of people. But I'm going to tell you something, they had perseverance because they weren't quitting. These were last gaspers that knew their lives were on the line. And they were going to hang in there, and they hung in there. No doubt in my mind there was some divine help going on there. So listen, you get around a group of people, and there's only like, you know, maybe 70 of you, and all of you have under like 3 years of sobriety. You know, you kind of wonder, man, do I need to tell this person like all my stuff? So what they would do, and what they did back in the day, is they recommended you go to a priest or person of the cloth or somebody that you could trust. It's different today. It's completely different today. Our fellowship, there's millions of people in it. There's people that are in our fellowship that are in the fellowship of the Spirit, on the rocket, living that sixth sense and just, you know, full of integrity and honor and got that thing going on that you can trust, that you can do a fifth step with, and they will hold your confidence. Most importantly is that they know what you're driving at. Because if they're an effective sponsor, they're going to want to know what your vision is. Who do you want to become? We know who you are. What do you desire to have on display when you show up on earth? Who do you want to be? We just saw what being addicted to material stuff did to us and others. We saw the devastation. We saw what it did to our lives and to the lives of other people when we trampled on them trying to get more of this and more of that and more of the other. We saw what that does. Hopefully at this point it's like, man, you see the destruction behind that addiction to more. And hopefully now you're driving at some principled living, some things that you can incorporate into your new constitution that will be an asset for others when you come on the scene. Because you're not going to know the payoff or the reward from keeping your word until you keep your word. You're not going to know the reward and the payoff for being honest until you start telling the truth. You're not going to know the payoff for integrity until you start being integrous. You've got to have a vision. And hopefully the sponsor that you have emulates those qualities that you want. So, you pick the person, hopefully your sponsor, that, because I'm going to tell you, you need step four to do step five. And you need step four, you need the resentment column list, you need the first column so that you can do eight and nine. Right? You also need step four so that you can do five and six and seven. We're going to talk about that when we get there. But we've got to move out of this thing. We've got to be able to talk to somebody about it and talk candidly and openly and freely. All right? Listen, you're only going to have to do this one time. We have a 10 step that will keep us on the spiritual beam. And like, really, what do we got to lose by holding on to secrets? The secrets that you continue to hold on to are the very ones that will get you drunk. Period. So here's where it says that we tell somebody all our life story. So this is a step where we go over our four step. We tell everybody, we tell this person exactly what happened. It says that we must be entirely honest with somebody if we're going to expect to live long and happily in this world. Okay? It cautions us about saving our skin at somebody else's expense. We don't want to do that. We're here to clean off our side of the street. We're here to get right with God and other people. It says the rule is we must be hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. Talks about the importance of being able to keep a confidence for those sponsors in here that are getting ready to undergo a fist step with their sponsees. But they say when we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. There's your timeline. There's your timeline. They say that for those that have this idea or this attitude that, you know what, I've already gone to God with these things, and you know, why do I have to tell it to another human being? Well, if you've got a mind that's full of greed and lust and anger and self-pity and self-loathing and dishonesty and inconsideration and fear, you don't want to go to the same kind of person to tell that garbage to. So if you're telling yourself, what good's that going to do? It's like that consulting with the idiot. You know what I mean? Half is selling, the other half's buying. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. It says we pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Now listen to this. Remember, we're after freedom here. We're after relationship with God here. That's what we're after. It says, once we have taken this step with holding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but it says now we begin to have a spiritual experience. If you want to know what a spiritual experience begins to feel like, you will need to do the fifth step before that happens. You may have tremendous relief and joy in being escaping disaster and the pains of active addiction. But to have a shift in personality and to have a vast change or a beginning of change in our feeling and outlook, you will need to do 4 and 5. Okay? It's just the way it is. It says the feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. I'm going to tell you something, people. The past will not be able to hurt you anymore. It just won't. All the ghosts and all the demons and all those things that have been haunting us will go from inside to outside. This brings tremendous relief. It will bring peace. It will bring purpose. You will have, if you had anything like I had, the biggest feeling that I got out of doing this fifth step was a feeling like I was contributing to the betterment of my own life. Like for the first time in my life, I was doing something to become something for humanity instead of sucking the life out of it. That all of a sudden I started to feel like God was really doing for me what I could never do for myself. I would have never written this script for me. And I felt for the first time in my life that I wasn't living a lie. That I told somebody the truth. They knew me through and through in the presence of God. And if even it was for one person, they knew who I was and loved me and accepted me for who I was and not the fraud that I had become. It's amazing, amazing stuff. It says, returning home, we're going to get back into this timeline thing in case anybody's wondering. Remember, this hasn't taken very long. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. That's 60 minutes in Florida. Carefully reviewing what we've done. Carefully reviewing what we talked about. Reflecting on it. Thinking about it. Not listening to music. Not watching TV. Not being distracted. Alone for an hour. With ourselves and our experience. Okay? We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. So we thank Him. Tells us to do that. Taking this book down from the shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps, carefully reading the first 5 proposals and asking if we omitted anything. Were we not clear? Were we not fully disclosing everything that we needed to do with our sponsor? It says, for we're building an arch through which we will walk a free man and woman at last. That's why we're here. Right? Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? They say that if we continue to hold on to any old attitudes, ideas, and beliefs, the result is nil. That half measures avail us nothing. That there is no middle of the road solution. Make sure you are grounded in truth here. It's only your life. Your life hangs in the balance. Your happiness, your peace, your destiny, your purpose, everything hangs in the balance. What have you got to lose? Right? And you read the first 5 steps and ask yourself if you're 100% maximum, they used to say, in knowing that lives for you. Next week, we're going to get on a program of action to become that which God created us to be. Thanks.